Hello, and welcome to Your Health, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk. I'm health editor April Fulton. This week, we'll hear about the long-term effects of obesity in kids. It's not just physical. And about an easier and less icky way to give CPR that just might save someone's life. But first, let's take a look at treatment that sounds really promising, but for the most part has yet to deliver. That's stem cell therapy, the idea that injecting cells into our bodies can cure disease or regenerate damaged parts. The problem is, it often doesn't work, but that doesn't stop desperate patients. NPR's Richard Knox has this report.
Google stem cell treatments and you'll get a gazillion websites.
So we've gotten 13,400,000 hits.
That's Dr. George Daly of Children's Hospital in Boston, one of the world's foremost stem cell researchers. He pulls up some of the sites. They look pretty convincing.
Many of them have the veneer of scientific respectability.
White-coated scientists, technicians holding up flasks of mysterious colored liquids, and testimonials from healthy-looking clients cavorting on the beach. Sometimes stem cell therapies actually work. Some can cure blood diseases such as leukemia. But many of these websites offer treatments given abroad that are not approved in the United States. Daly says they're nothing more than scams. They claim to cure diabetes, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's disease.
Everything from A to Z. For the vast majority of these conditions, stem cells are not the answer today. We hope they will be in the future, but they aren't today.
Even so, there's a magical aura around stem cells. In the test tube, they can turn into any type of tissue. They promise regeneration. To desperate patients with incurable diseases, that notion is irresistible. Daly pulls out a stack of papers 6 inches thick, hundreds of emails and letters from people seeking stem cell cures.
Here's one that says, "Dear Dr. Daly, I have a son with optic nerve hypoplasia. This is a child who's blind. I'm considering the umbilical cord stem cell treatment in China. I'm interested in why you are so skeptical."
It's because Daly's seen no evidence stem cells can cure blindness. I decided to check up on children who've been treated for this very problem at a clinic in eastern China. It turns out there's an American specialist who was curious to see if it worked. So he examined a bunch of kids treated there.
Incredibly sweet families, salt-of-the-earth people.
Dr. Shailesh Kaushal at the University of Massachusetts invited 8 of these families to come in for free examinations. The results?
There didn't seem to be any ostensible benefit from the stem cell infusion. In all of them, as far as we could tell, in talking to the parents as well.
So, nothing on the eye exams, nothing on the brain scans, and then Kaushal took the children to a pancake house for breakfast.
And I watched all the kids, and so did my wife, and they all struggled to find their food. That means you can't take a fork and cut a piece of pancake and get it to your mouth. It was heart-wrenching.
Some parents acknowledged the treatments had done no good. Others were sure it had. All of them paid tens of thousands of dollars for it. Kaushal says, understandably, parents really want to believe the treatment worked.
For something that was such a stupendous effort to do, you know, to raise all this money, to get over to China and get this treatment, you might imagine that there is certain psychological expectations of the treatment, even more than that, emotional.
A lot of people are falling for unproven stem cell treatments. Another leading researcher, Irving Weissman of Stanford, says it hit him when he gave a talk in rural Montana. Afterward, 2 farmers came up and told him they'd gone out of the country for stem cell treatments costing up to $85,000 with no effect.
It pointed out to me that a sea change had happened with the advent of the web as a free place to make claims, make advertising, make money.
Weissman, then president of the International Society for Stem Cell Research, decided to set up a consumer watchdog program.
To help patients and their caregivers look at a site that claims a therapy and find out pretty fast if it's a fraudulent site or if it's a legitimate therapy.
Patients are invited to submit names of clinics. The Stem Cell Society will investigate and post the results. Richard Knox, NPR News.
Now Now let's talk about an experimental therapy that seems to be working. NPR's Patty Naiman reports that when doctors implant a tiny telescope in a patient's eye, they start seeing better. It helps some people with severe vision loss known as macular degeneration, a disease that affects millions of seniors.
Marion Orr is 80 years old with a big family. 5 children, 8 grandchildren, 4 great-grandchildren, lots of graduations, weddings, school events. In other words, lots to see. So when Orr's vision began declining in her mid-70s, she got scared.
Gradually, it diminished where I couldn't see. If I looked at you straight on, I couldn't see your face. I'd just see around your head.
Macular degeneration is often inherited, and the blurred vision Orr experienced is pretty typical.
I couldn't see the eyes and the nose. I could just see the round head, that was all, and sort of like a halo was over it.
So when Orr's cousin read about an experimental treatment, Orr quickly got in touch with one of the researchers, and before she knew it, she was one of 219 patients to have a tiny telescope implanted in her eye. Massachusetts eye surgeon Catherine Colby was one of the researchers involved in the experiment.
If you think of the eye as an old-style camera that had film in it, and in macular degeneration, the film becomes damaged so that the image that's created has holes in it. So, for example, someone who is looking at a face wouldn't be able to see the face. And what the telescope does is by magnifying the image, it allows the part of the vision that's missing to become subsequently smaller.
Which sort of fills in the holes, making the picture that the eye sees more complete. But like all telescopes, when vision gets narrowly focused, visual periphery disappears, which is why the telescope is implanted in only one eye. The other eye is used for peripheral vision.
So patients need to learn to use the implanted telescope eye for near activities. For example, if they're looking to see what time it is on a clock, but the other eye would be used to scan the room to find where the clock is.
After surgery, patients do eye exercises to train their eyes to work together. It wasn't hard for Marion Orr, who was used to wearing contacts, one for distance and one for close up. For her, the tiny new telescope has put the bustle back into her life.
I'm very active in my church, and I'm a lunch buddy at one of the schools nearby. Go and have lunch once a week with these little children that are in first and second grades. I read a lot, regular books, and I can read those. I can read the newspaper. Let me see. I watch TV a lot. I'm busy, that's for sure.
Practically all the patients in the study had their vision improve, and 75% of them, just like Orr, had major improvement. But the telescope can damage the cornea. In the study, 10 out of 219 patients had corneal problems. 5 required a corneal transplant, which is why the FDA is requiring the manufacturer to monitor safety for at least 5 years. And the eye telescope isn't for everyone.
There you go. Down and left again.
Retinal surgeon George Williams examines a patient at William Beaumont Hospital in Royal Oak, Michigan. Williams is with the American Academy of Ophthalmology. He says the telescope won't work for patients who've had cataracts removed.
Because in order to implant this device, we need to remove the natural lens or the cataract and then use a portion of the natural lens to position and support the telescope.
And for patients in the early stages of vision loss due to macular degeneration, Williams says medications are effective and a lot less invasive than the telescope.
These drugs are injected directly into the eye on a monthly basis. And with that, we're able to prevent severe visual loss in over 90% of patients.
So Williams says if patients get treated as soon as possible for macular degeneration, they may never get to the point where they need an implanted telescope. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
An outbreak of whooping cough in California is being called the worst in 50 years. 6 babies have died from the highly contagious respiratory infection this year, but it's not for the reasons you might think. While some parents are opting out as part of a movement that doesn't trust vaccines, an increasing number of doctors report that they can't afford to get the vaccines to their patients, particularly in rural areas, Kelly Weiss reports.
Marcia McKay is a family doctor in a small Sierra Foothills town. She says she's used to doing it all at her rural practice in Twain Heart, California, but this is something new.
Oof.
McKay's on the phone with a loan officer trying to get a $25,000 line of credit.
So part of what you do is that you make a business plan for me, right?
She says she needs the extra cash so she can buy vaccines of all things.
I'm fairly allergic to high debt, and I really would rather not do this.
McKay negotiated a contract with Blue Cross Insurance to determine her vaccine reimbursement rates. But she says she doesn't get paid for the full price of the vaccines, like for whooping cough.
Costs me $46.90, and Blue Cross will pay me $28 for it.
In other words, she'll lose money, so for now, she's not giving the shots. She's worried, though. There have been a few whooping cough cases in Twain Heart, and McKay's afraid infants in her community could die without the vaccine.
The biggest issue for me is I just don't feel like I'm doing everything that I'm supposed to be doing for my patients, and that just makes me feel kind of inadequate as a doctor.
So now, along with trying to get a loan, she is shopping online for discounted vaccines. In the meantime, one of McKay's patients, Erica Jambruno, has three kids who need the vaccines right now. Jambruno says she'll have to drive 30 minutes to the nearest community clinic to get them. The whooping cough shots are $10 apiece and only available one afternoon a week. Jambruno says this is frustrating because she has private health insurance.
It's definitely an inconvenience on the drive, and, you know, then you got to stand in line behind everyone else, and it's only between, like, 1 and 4 on Tuesdays.
Plus, she says she's reluctant to get vaccines from someone other than her trusted doctor.
But if I go to the clinic and I don't really know them and it's kind of a rush job, it's easier for me to go, maybe I'm not going to do this.
Doctors like Marcia McKay in rural areas are one of the groups most likely to drop childhood immunizations. That's according to Gary Freed, a physician at the University of Michigan Health System. In a 2008 article he published in the journal Pediatrics, he found that about 25% of family doctors were seriously considering no longer giving vaccines. Freed says many were losing money on immunizations.
The issue is often that physicians are not good business people.
But beyond that, he identified some other surprising issues.
We found, interestingly, that there was quite a broad range of what physicians were paying for vaccines. We also found remarkable differences with regard to reimbursement. Some physicians were being reimbursed more than twice as much as other physicians were by their most common insurer, again for the same vaccine.
California Association of Health Plans President Patrick Johnston says the private insurance market is a largely unregulated competitive place. So he says doctors have to find good deals on vaccines. And Johnston says that can be difficult if you're in a solo practice in a rural area.
Individual doctors may not have the bargaining power of a big group, but it's their choice to be in a big group or be an individual.
Researcher Gary Freed says family doctors need to band together and negotiate better vaccine rates. But for Marcia McKay in Twain Heart, she says it's not that easy. So she's supporting a state bill sponsored by the California Academy of Family Physicians. If it's passed, the law would make health insurers reimburse doctors for more of their vaccine costs. For NPR News, I'm Kelly Weiss in Sacramento.
Quick, what do you do when you see someone go down in a crowd? Do you call for help? Do you check their vital signs? If they're not breathing, do you start CPR? Well, most Americans who have heart attacks do not get prompt CPR, maybe in part because bystanders fear the mouth-to-mouth contact with a stranger. But the squeamish should take heart. Experts are pointing out that the mouth-to-mouth part may not be necessary to save somebody. NPR's Richard Knox has the story.
The new CPR doesn't require special skills or training. It also doesn't involve mouth-to-mouth contact. All you have to do is push on the chest to keep the blood flowing until emergency medical technicians arrive. That means it's a lot easier for the EMTs who answer 911 calls to coach people in how to do it over the phone.
All right. night. How was your mom?
Like this episode, a woman in Boston has called 911 to say that her mother stopped breathing.
She stopped breathing?
Yeah.
All right, well, then she stopped breathing. I need somebody to do CPR. So I only need one person.
Okay.
The call taker, an EMT, coaches the woman on how to resuscitate her 76-year-old mother.
All right, well, then I'm going to need you to put the lady flat on the bed and start CPR.
All right.
One hand on top of the other, front of her chest, between her nipples, and press down.
Okay.
All right, now I'm going to need you to do that 30 times.
It seems to be working.
She's breathing.
If she's breathing, I don't want you doing CPR. If she's not breathing, I need you to do CPR.
Pressing on the chest isn't a good idea when somebody's breathing on their own. But the woman stops breathing again, so the EMT tells the daughter to go back to pushing on the chest. A minute later, EMTs arrive and take over. Joe O'Hare says this is exactly how he'd like to see every case work. He's deputy superintendent of Boston's Emergency Medical Services.
The patient survived, went home with good cerebral performance, as far as we know. So that CPR probably saved that woman's life, so she did well.
This could happen a lot more often. Most of the time somebody has a cardiac arrest, there's somebody who could help until the EMTs arrive. But bystanders do CPR only about 25% of the time. Partly that's because many people aren't comfortable with the mouth-to-mouth part, called rescue breathing. Dr. Thomas Ray of the Seattle King County Health Department says streamlining CPR may save many more lives.
Rates of bystander CPR haven't changed a great deal in most communities in the last decade or two. By making it simpler, maybe we can move that needle a little bit.
It's begun to work in Seattle. Their 911 dispatchers have been pushing the new CPR for the past year with good results.
We saw that bystanders were more likely to get CPR started when the instructions were just chest compressions as opposed to chest compression plus rescue breathing.
Ray led a study in this week's New England Journal of Medicine that compared nearly 1,000 cardiac arrest victims who got traditional CPR from bystanders versus 1,000 who got the new style CPR. There was no difference in survival, around 11 or 12% in each group. That's not great, but Ray thinks a big difference will come if more bystanders are willing to do the new CPR, and he thinks more 911 dispatchers will be able to convince them to try.
A dispatcher can say, I'm going to tell you exactly what to do. Let's get started. An assertive, confident dispatcher can make a world of difference. I mean, they can save lives.
A similar study from Sweden also shows the new CPR is just as good. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
Now, we all know that there are big risks associated with carrying around lots of extra weight, for kids, too. Diabetes, heart disease, and cancer are all associated with obesity, and the first ladies put the issue in the spotlight like never before. But as NPR's Patty Naiman reports, it's not just physical health. New research shows that obese people who have battled severe weight problems off and on since childhood also face social and economic problems.
Philippa Clark, a researcher at the University of Michigan, wanted to know what happens to people who've been overweight or obese since adolescence. She compared one group of 40-year-olds who were normal weight at high school graduation but who gained weight gradually over time to another group of 40-year-olds who were overweight since age 19.
We found that those people who were persistently overweight were more likely to not have gone on to have any further education beyond their high school degree, to be receiving welfare or unemployment compensation at age 40, and to have no current partner.
Clark says her study didn't address why, but she speculates these adults probably experienced discrimination as children, discrimination that diminished their self-esteem and, in turn, their aspirations. Other research supports that theory. Yale psychologist Kelly Brownell has done research showing that overweight kids are far more likely to report being teased.
Teasing that comes directly from teachers in some cases, certainly from peers, sometimes even by their own families. This gets internalized, so overweight children feel inferior, feel like there's something defective with themselves, and therefore they tend not to aspire, and this isn't true in all cases, but a lot of them tend not to aspire to such heights because they don't believe they deserve it.
Brownell says his studies have shown that overweight people are 26 times more likely to report discrimination than their normal weight counterparts. And Brownell says discrimination against overweight individuals has increased significantly over the past decade, despite the fact that more adults are becoming overweight. One of the reasons, he says, may be that people think overweight overweight adults have only themselves to blame. They should eat less and exercise more. But Brownell says blame is simply unreasonable, particularly when it comes to children and weight, and especially in low-income neighborhoods where markets are often inadequate and places to exercise are nearly non-existent.
The social climate and our toxic food environment is so disastrous that more and more people are having trouble resisting it, and that's really what's explaining the high prevalence of obesity. So it's unfair to put people in an environment where weight gain is a very, very strong possibility and then to blame them for having the problem.
Changing the environment is a key to solving the problem. Pediatrician Joe Thompson is a specialist in childhood obesity at the University of Arkansas College of Medicine. Over the past decade, Thompson says the state's made changes in schools to promote an environment where it's easier for kids to make healthy choices.
In Arkansas, we've actually tried to change the offerings in our school cafeterias and trying to restrict some of the less nutritious available foods in vending machines and others throughout the school campus.
And Thompson says those efforts have paid off.
The rate of the epidemic has slowed nationwide, and we have actually shown a halt to the epidemic.
Supporting research findings that suggest the best way to confront the medical and social effects of being overweight or obese is to prevent it in the first place. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
For more on obesity, which we cover quite a lot here at the NPR Science Desk, check out our health page at npr.org/health. Also, be sure to check out our health blog, Shots, at npr.org/shots. This week, you'll find out how a 747 might affect your relationship with your doctor, where the country's cleanest beaches are, and why the asbestos business is still thriving in the developing world. That's all for the Your Health podcast this week. I'm April Fulton. Thanks for listening.